This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Liar's Poker, Rising Through the Wreckage on Wall Street by Michael Lewis. Read for you by the author.
It was sometime early in 1986, the first year of the decline of my firm, Salomon Brothers. Our chairman, John Goodfriend, left his desk at the head of the trading floor and went for a walk. At any given moment on the trading floor, billions of dollars were being risked by bond traders. Goodfriend was the last person a nerve-wracked trader wanted to see, especially when he snuck up from behind and surprised you. Often as not, our chairman just hovered quietly for a bit, then left. This day in 1986, however, Goodfriend did something strange. Instead of terrifying us all, he walked a straight line to John Merriweather, a Salomon board member and also one of Salomon's finest bond traders. He whispered a few words. The traders in the vicinity eavesdropped. What Goodfriend said has become a legend at Salomon Brothers and a visceral part of its corporate identity. He said, "One hand, $1 million, no tears." The King of Wall Street, as Business Week had dubbed Goodfriend, wanted to play a single hand of a game called Liar's Poker for $1 million. He played the game most afternoons with Merriweather. The peculiar feature of Goodfriend's challenge this time was the size of the stake. Normally his bets didn't exceed a few $100s. The final two words of his challenge, no tears, meant that the loser was expected to suffer a great deal of pain, but wasn't entitled to whine about it. It seemed an act of sheer lunacy. Merriweather was the Liar's Poker champion of the Salomon Brothers trading floor. The whole absurd situation needs putting into context. John Merriweather had made hundreds of millions of dollars for Salomon Brothers. He had an ability to hide his state of mind. Most traders divulge whether they are making or losing money by the way they speak or move. With Merriweather, you could never, ever tell. Merriweather cast a spell over the young traders who worked for him. They became disciples. They became obsessed by the game of Liar's Poker. They regarded it as their game. John Goodfriend was always the outsider in their game. When you managed a firm, you received your quota of envy, fear, and admiration, but for all the wrong reasons. You did not make the money for Salomon. You did not take risk. You were hostage to your producers. They took risk. The money came from risk-takers such as Merriweather, and whether it came or not was really beyond Goodfriend's control. That's why many people thought that the single rash act of challenging the arbitrage boss to one hand for $1 million was Goodfriend's way of showing he was a player, too. People like John Merriweather believed that Liar's Poker had a lot in common with bond trading. It tested a trader's character. It honed a trader's instincts. A good player made a good trader, and vice versa. We all understood it. In Liar's Poker, a group of people, as few as 2, as many as 10, form a circle. Each player holds a dollar bill close to his chest and attempts to fool the others about the serial numbers printed on the face of his dollar bill. One trader begins by making a bid. He says, for example, 3 sixes. He means that all told, the serial numbers of the dollar bills held by every player, including himself, contain at least 3 sixes. Once the first bid has been made, the game moves clockwise in the circle. Let's say the bid is 3 sixes. The player to the left of the bidder can bid higher numbers or challenge. That is like saying, "I doubt it." The bidding escalates until all the other players agree to challenge a single player's bid. Then, and only then, do the players reveal their serial numbers and determine who is bluffing whom. The hard part is reading the faces of the other players. The complexity arises when all players know how to bluff and double bluff. The code of the Liar's Poker player was something like the code of the gunslinger. It required a trader to accept all challenges. Because of the code, which was his code, John Merriweather felt obliged to play. But he knew it was stupid. For him, there was no upside. If he won, he upset Goodfriend. But if he lost, he was out of pocket $1 million. "No, John," Merriweather said. "I'd rather play for real money. $10 million, no tears." $10 million. It was a moment for all players to savor. Merriweather was playing Liar's Poker before the game even started. He was bluffing. Goodfriend considered the counterproposal. It would have been just like him to accept. Merely to entertain the thought was a luxury that must have pleased him well. It was good to be rich. Maybe the whole point of his challenge was to judge Meriwether's response. Even Goodfriend had to marvel at the king in action. Goodfriend smiled his own brand of forced smile and said, "You're crazy." "No," thought Meriwether, "just very, very good." I was living in London in the winter of 1984, finishing a master's degree at the London School of Economics, when I received an invitation to dine with the Queen Mother at St. James's Palace. What had been advertised as a close encounter with British royalty proved to be a fundraiser with 700 or 800 insurance salesmen. Somewhere in the palace, as luck would have it, were two managing directors from Solomon Brothers. I knew this only because, as luck would have it, I was seated between their wives. When one of the wives learned that I was preparing to enter the job market and was considering investment banking, she turned the evening into an interview. I was soon invited by her husband to the London offices of Solomon and introduced to traders and salesmen on the trading floor. I liked the commercial buzz of their environment, but I still did not have a formal job offer, and I wasn't subjected to a proper round of job interviews. A few days later, I received a call to have breakfast with Leo Corbett, the head of Solomon Recruiting. At breakfast, we had a pleasant talk, which was disconcerting, because Solomon Brothers recruiters were meant to be bastards. It seemed clear Corbett wanted me to work at Solomon, but he never came right out and proposed. Finally, I told a fellow student at the London School of Economics what had happened. As he badly wanted a job with Solomon Brothers, he knew exactly what I had to do. Solomon Brothers never made job offers. It only gave hints. The best thing for me to do was call Leo Corbett and take the job from him. So I did. I called him, reintroduced myself, and said, "I want to let you know that I accept." "Glad to have you on board," he said, and laughed. He explained that I would start life at the Brothers in a training program that commenced in July 1984 at the New York headquarters with 120 other students. Days passed. I knew nothing about trading, and as a result, next to nothing about Solomon Brothers. For Solomon Brothers is, more than any other firm on Wall Street, a firm run by traders. I knew only what I had read in the papers, and they said that Solomon Brothers was the world's most profitable investment bank. True as that might be, the process of landing a job with the firm had been suspiciously pleasant. 6,000 people had applied that year. Most of the people with whom I would eventually work were badly savaged in their interviews and had grisly stories to tell. I had no battle scars and felt mildly ashamed. Oh, all right, I confess. One of the reasons I pounced on the Solomon Brothers opportunity like a loose ball was that I had already seen the dark side of a Wall Street job hunt. As a college senior in 1981, I applied to banks. At the time, I didn't give trading so much as a passing thought. In this, I wasn't unusual. College seniors considered trading floors cages for untrained animals. My Princeton University class of 1982 was among the last to hold this view firmly. So we didn't apply to work on trading floors. Instead, we angled for lower-paying jobs in corporate finance, with a starting salary of about $25,000 plus bonus. When all was said and done, the pay came to around $6 an hour. The job title was Investment Banking Analyst. At Solomon Brothers, analysts were the lowest of the low. They photocopied, proofread, and assembled breathtakingly dull securities documents for 90-plus hours a week. A few of the very best analysts lost their will to live normal lives. They gave themselves entirely over to their employers and worked around the clock. By definition, an analyst's job lasted only 2 years. Then he was expected to go to business school. The analyst was a prisoner of his own narrowly focused ambition. He wanted money. There was one sure way to get it, and everyone with eyes in 1982 saw it. Major in economics, use your economics degree to get an analyst job on Wall Street, use your analyst job to get into the Harvard Business School, and worry about the rest of your life later. So, more than any other, the question that my classmates and I were asking was, how do I become a Wall Street analyst despite the logjam at the point of entry? 40% of the 1,300 members of Yale's graduating class of 1986 applied to one investment bank alone, First Boston. At Harvard, in 1987, the course in the Principles of Economics had 40 sections and 1,000 students. The enrollment had tripled in 10 years. An economics degree became a requirement for a job on Wall Street. In the midst of the hysteria, I was suitably hysterical. I had made a conscious decision not to study economics at Princeton, partly because everyone else was doing it for what sounded to me like the wrong reasons. I landed in one of the least used departments on campus. Art history was the opposite of economics. No one wanted it on his resume. Art history, as an economics major once told me, is for preppy girls from Connecticut. The chief economic purpose of art history was clandestinely to lift the grade point averages of the economics students. To be fair, art was only the start of my problems. It didn't help that my resume listed bartending and skydiving as skills. Born and raised in the Deep South, I had never heard of investment bankers until a few months before my first job interview. Nevertheless, Wall Street seemed very much like the place to be at the time. I was frightened to miss the express bus on which everyone I knew seemed to have a reserved seat. I certainly had no fixed idea of what to do when I graduated from college, and Wall Street paid top dollar for what I could do, which was nothing. My motives were shallow. That wouldn't have mattered and could even have been an advantage if I had felt the slightest conviction that I deserved a job, but I didn't. Many of my classmates had sacrificed the better part of their formal educations for Wall Street. I had sacrificed nothing. In short, I wasn't going to be an investment banker anytime soon. My moment of reckoning came immediately after the first interview of the 1982 season with the Wall Street firm of Lehman Brothers. Investment bankers had a technique known as the stress interview. If you were invited to Lehman's New York offices, your first interview might begin with the interviewer asking you to open the window. The window was sealed shut. That was, of course, the point. The interviewer just wanted to see whether your inability to comply with his request led you to yank, pull, and sweat until finally you melted into a puddle of foiled ambition. Or, as one sad applicant was rumored to have done, threw a chair through the window. Another stress-inducing trick was the silent treatment. You'd walk into the interview chamber. The man in the chair would say nothing. You'd say hello. He'd stare. You'd say that you'd come for a job interview. He'd stare some more. You'd make a stupid joke. He'd stare and shake his head. You were on tenterhooks. Then he'd pick up a newspaper, or worse, your resume, and begin to read. He was testing your ability to take control of a meeting. In this case, presumably, it was acceptable to throw a chair through a window. On the appointed day, at the appointed hour, I rubbed two sweaty palms together outside the interview chamber and did a quick equipment check, like an astronaut preparing for liftoff. My strengths? I was an overachiever, a team player, and a people person, whatever that meant. My weaknesses? I worked too hard and tended to move too fast for the organizations I joined. My name was called. The greatest absurdity of the college investment banking interview was the people the investment bank sent to conduct them. Many of them hadn't worked on Wall Street for more than a year, but they had acquired Wall Street personas. One of their favorite words was professional. Sitting stiffly, shaking firmly, speaking crisply, and sipping a glass of ice water were professional. Laughing and scratching your armpits were not. The young man began to fire questions at me. Perhaps the best way to describe our encounter is to recount, as best as memory will allow, what passed for our conversation. Square young man, why don't you explain to me the difference between commercial banking and investment banking? Me. Investment bankers underwrite securities. Commercial bankers make loans. Square young man, do you know the size of the U.S. GNP? Me. I'm not sure. Isn't it about $500 billion? Square young man. More like $3 trillion. You know, we interview hundreds of people here for each position. You're up against a lot of economics majors who know their stuff. Why do you want to be an investment banker? Obviously, the honest answer was that I didn't know. That was unacceptable. After a waffle or two, I gave him what I figured he wanted to hear. Me. Well, really, when you get right down to it, I want to make money. Square young man. That's not a good reason. You work long hours in this job, and you have to be motivated by more than just money. Frankly, we try to discourage people from our business who are too interested in money. That's all. That's all. The words ring in my ears. Before I could stop it from happening, I was standing outside the cubicle in a cold sweat. Why did the square young man from Lehman take offense at the suggestion? A friend who eventually won a job with Lehman Brothers later explained. It's taboo, he said. You're supposed to talk about the thrill of doing deals and the excitement of working with outstanding people, but never ever mention money. From then on, whenever an investment banker asked for my motives, I dutifully handed him the correct answers. That money wasn't the binding force was, of course, complete and utter bullshit. Did anyone doubt the importance of money on Wall Street other than people from Wall Street when talking to people from elsewhere? Still, the tale has a happy ending. Lehman Brothers eventually went belly up in early 1984. The senior partners were forced to go hat in hand to Wall Street rival Shearson, which bought them out. Whether Lehman's misfortune was directly related to its unwillingness to admit it was out to make money, I do not know. I remember almost exactly how I felt and what I saw my first day at Salomon Brothers. There was a cold shiver doing laps around my body. I rose early to walk around Wall Street before going to the office. I had never seen the place before. There was a river at one end and a graveyard at the other. In between was vintage Manhattan, a deep, narrow canyon in which yellow cabs smacked into raised sewer lids, potholes, and garbage. Armies of worried men in suits stormed off the Lexington Avenue subway line and marched down the crooked pavements. For rich people, they didn't look very happy. Salomon Brothers had written me in London to announce that it would pay me an MBA's wage, though I had no MBA, of $42,000, plus a bonus after the first 6 months of $6,000 more. Perhaps it is worth explaining where this money was coming from. In 1985, Wall Street was hot, and Salomon Brothers was Wall Street's most profitable firm. Wall Street traffics in stocks and bonds. At the end of the 1970s, Salomon Brothers knew more about bonds than any firm on Wall Street. How to value them, how to trade them, and how to sell them. The rest of Wall Street had been content to let Salomon Brothers be the best bond traders because the occupation was neither terribly profitable nor prestigious. The biggest myth about bond traders, and therefore the greatest misunderstanding about the unprecedented prosperity on Wall Street in the 1980s, is that they make their money by taking large risks. A few do, and all traders take small risks, but most traders act simply as toll takers. In other words, Salomon carved a tiny fraction out of each financial transaction. This adds up. The Salomon salesman sells $50 million worth of a new IBM bond to pension fund X. The Salomon trader, who provides the salesman with the bonds, takes for himself an eighth of a percentage point, or $62,500. He may, if he wishes, take more. In the bond market, unlike in the stock market, commissions are not openly stated. Now the fun begins. Once the trader knows the location of the IBM bonds and the temperament of their owner, he doesn't have to be outstandingly clever to make the bonds move again. He can generate his own magic. He can, for example, pressure one of his salesmen to persuade insurance company Y that the IBM bonds are worth more than pension fund X paid for them initially. Whether it is true is irrelevant. The trader buys the bonds from X and sells them to Y and takes out another eighth of a percentage point, and the pension fund is happy to make a small profit in such a short time. In this process, it helps if neither of the parties on either side of the middleman knows the value of the treasure. The men on the trading floor have PhDs in man's ignorance. In any market, as in any poker game, there is a fool. The astute investor Warren Buffett is fond of saying that any player unaware of the fool in the market probably is the fool in the market. Salomon Brothers bond traders knew about fools because that was their job. Knowing about markets is knowing about other people's weaknesses. And a fool, they would say, was a person who was willing to sell a bond for less than it was worth, or buy a bond for more. A bond was worth only as much as the person who valued it properly was willing to pay. And Salomon, to complete the circle, was the firm that valued the bonds properly. but none of this explains why Salomon Brothers was particularly profitable in the 1980s. Making profits on Wall Street is a bit like eating the stuffing from a turkey. Some higher authority must first put the stuffing into the turkey. One of the benevolent hands doing the stuffing belonged to the Federal Reserve. At a rare Saturday press conference on October the 6th, 1979, Paul Volcker, chairman of the Fed, announced that the money supply would cease to fluctuate with the business cycle and interest rates would float. The event, I think, marks the beginning of the golden age of the bond man. Had Volcker never pushed through his radical change in policy, the world would be many bond traders and one memoir, the poorer. For in practice, interest rates would swing wildly. Bond prices move inversely, lockstep, to rates of interest. Allowing interest rates to swing wildly meant allowing bond prices to swing wildly. Bonds had been conservative investments into which investors put their savings when they didn't fancy a gamble in the stock market. After Volcker's speech, bonds became objects of speculation, a means of creating wealth rather than merely storing it. Overnight, the bond market was transformed from a backwater into a casino. Once Volcker had set interest rates free, the other hand stuffing the turkey went to work. America's borrowers. As the American government, consumers, and corporations borrowed more money, the volume of bonds exploded. Another way to look at this is that investors were lending money more freely than ever before. The combined indebtedness of the three groups in 1977 was $323 billion, much of which wasn't bonds, but loans made by commercial banks. By 1985, the three groups had borrowed $7 trillion. What is more, thanks to financial entrepreneurs at places like Salomon and the shakiness of commercial banks, a much greater percentage of the debt was cast in the form of bonds than ever before. A Salomon salesman who had in the past moved $5 million worth of merchandise through the trader's books each week was now moving $300 million through each day. He, the trader, and the firm began to get rich. And they decided, for reasons best known to themselves, to invest some of their winnings in buying people like me. Classes at Salomon Brothers were held on the 23rd floor of its building on the southeastern tip of Manhattan. As I walked into the training area, the other trainees were gathered in packs, chattering. Cliques had gelled. Already, opinions had formed of who was cut out for the Salomon trading floor and who was a loser. One group of men stood in a circle playing a game I didn't recognize, but now know to be liar's poker. They were laughing, cursing, eyeing each other sideways, and generally behaving in a brotherly, traderly manner. We were as civil to the big man addressing the class as we had been to anyone, which wasn't saying much. He was the speaker for the entire afternoon. That meant he was trapped for 3 hours in the 10-yard trench in the floor at the front of the room. The man paced back and forth in the channel like a coach on the sidelines. We sat in rows of interconnected school chairs, 22 rows of white male trainees in white shirts, punctuated by two blacks, a cluster of Japanese, and the occasional female in a blue blazer. The room was hot and stuffy. We were only 1 week into our 5-month training program, and I was already exhausted. I sank in my chair. The speaker, a leading bond salesman at Salomon, was doing well with the crowd. People in the back row listened. All around the room, trainees put down their New York Times crossword puzzles. The man was telling us how to survive. "You got to think of Salomon Brothers as a jungle," he said. "The trading floor is a jungle," he went on, "and the guy you end up working for is your jungle leader. You've got to learn from your boss. He's key. Imagine if I take two people and I put them in the middle of the jungle and I give one person a jungle guide and the other person nothing. Inside the jungle, there's a lot of bad shit going down. Outside the jungle, there's a TV that's got the NCAA finals on and a huge fridge full of Bud." The speaker had found the secret to managing the Salomon Brothers class of 1985. Win the hearts and minds of the back row. Even when they felt merely ambivalent about a speaker, back row people slept or chucked paper wads at the wimps in the front row. But if the back row people for some reason didn't care for a speaker, all hell broke loose. Not now. primitive revelation swept through the back of the classroom at the sound of the jungle drums. The guys in the back row were leaning forward in their seats for the first time all day. Ooh, ah. With the back row neutralized, the speaker effectively controlled the entire audience, for the people sitting in the front row were on automatic pilot. They were the same as front row people all over the world, only more so. Most graduates of the Harvard Business School sat in the front row. "A huge fridge full of buds," said the speaker, a second time, "and chances are good that the guy with the jungle guide is going to be the first one through the jungle to the TV and the beer. Not to say the other guy won't eventually get there too, but..." Here he stopped pacing and even gave the audience a little sly look. "He'll be real thirsty, and there's not going to be any beer left when he arrives." The guys in the back row liked it. They fell all over each other, slapping palms, and looked as silly as white men in suits do when they pretend to be black soul brothers. When not listening to this sort of speech, we faced a much smaller man with a row of Bic fine points in a plastic case in his breast pocket, otherwise known as a nerd pack, explaining to us how to convert a semi-annual bond yield to an annual bond yield. The guys in the back row didn't like that. "Fuck the fucking bond math," they said. "Tell us about the jungle." Why Solomon let it happen, I still don't understand. The firm's management created the training program, then walked away. In the ensuing anarchy, the bad drove out the good, the big drove out the small, and the brawn drove out the brains. There was a single trait common to denizens of the back row. They were victims of the myth, especially popular at Solomon Brothers, that a traitor is a savage, and a great traitor is a great savage. This wasn't exactly correct. The trading floor held evidence to that effect, but it also held evidence to the contrary. People believed whatever they wanted to. There was another cause for the hooliganism. The winners of the Solomon interviewing process were pitted against one another in the classroom. In short, the baddest of the bad were competing for jobs. Contrary to what we expected when we arrived, we were not assured of employment. "Look to your left and look to your right," more than one speaker said. "In a year, one of those people will be out on the street." Across the top of the job placement blackboard appeared the name of each department on the trading floor. Municipal bonds, corporate bonds, government bonds, etc. Along the side of the board was each office in the firm. Atlanta, Dallas, New York, etc. The trainee was driven to despair by the thought that he might land somewhere awful in the matrix, or nowhere at all. Trading mortgages in New York was mouth-wateringly good. But the absolute worst was the slot marked Equities in Dallas. Equities in Dallas became training program shorthand for "just bury that lowest form of human scum where it will never be seen again." Within weeks after our arrival, the managers of each department had begun to debate our relative merits. But the managers were traitors at heart. They couldn't discuss a person, place, or thing without also trading it. So they began to trade trainees, like slaves. One day you'd see three of them leaning over the fat blue binder that held our photographs and resumes. The next day you'd hear that you'd been swapped for one front row person and one draft choice from the next training program. You needed a sponsor, one of 112 managing directors. There was one small problem, of course. Bosses were not always eager to befriend trainees. After all, what was in it for them? A managing director grew interested only if he believed you were widely desired. He won points when he spirited away a popular trainee from other managing directors. The approach of many a trainee, therefore, was to create the illusion of desirability. Then bosses wanted him not for any sound reason, but simply because other bosses wanted him. A few weeks into the training program, I made a friend on the trading floor, though not in the area in which I wanted to work. That friend pressed for me to join his department. I let other trainees know I was pursued. They told their friends on the trading floor, who in turn became curious. Eventually the man I wanted to work for overheard others talking about me and asked me to breakfast. Within the training class, a dispute arose over whether, under the circumstances, groveling was acceptable. Each trainee had to decide for himself. Thus was born the Great Divide. Those who chose to put on a full court grovel found seats in the front of the classroom where they sat, lips puckered, through the entire 5-month program. Those who treasured their pride feigned cool indifference by sitting in the back row and hurling paper wads at managing directors. I considered myself an exception, of course. I was accused by some of being a front row person because I asked too many questions. I lamely compensated for my curiosity by hurling a few paper wads at important traders. And my stock rose dramatically in the back row when I was thrown out of class for reading the newspaper while a trader spoke. Of all exceptions, however, the Japanese were the greatest. The Japanese undermined any analysis of our classroom culture. All 6 of them sat in the front row and slept. Their leader was a man named Yoshi. Each morning and afternoon, the back row boys made bets on how many minutes it would take Yoshi to fall asleep. Yoshi was their hero. A small cheer would go up in the back row when Yoshi crashed, partly because someone had just won a pile of money, but also in appreciation of any man with the balls to fall asleep in the front row. The Solomon Brothers training program was, without a doubt, the finest start to a career on Wall Street. Upon completion, a trainee could take his experience and cash it in for twice the salary on any other Wall Street trading floor. He had achieved, by the standards of Wall Street, technical mastery of his subject. Over 3 months, leading salesmen, traders, and financiers shared their experiences with the class. They trafficked in unrefined street wisdom. How money travels around the world, any way it wants. How a trader feels and behaves, any way he wants. And how to schmooze a customer. After 3 months in the class, trainees circulated wearily around the trading floor every afternoon for 2 months more. All the while, there was a hidden agenda. To Solomonize the trainee. The trainee was made to understand, first, that inside Solomon Brothers, he was, as a trader once described us, lower than whale shit on the bottom of the ocean floor. And second, that lying under whale shit at Solomon Brothers was like rolling in clover compared to not being at Solomon Brothers at all. Each day after class, around 3 o'clock, we were pressured to move from the training class to the trading floor on the 41st floor. The trading floor, Power Central, was about a third the length of a football field and was lined with connected desks. Traders sitting elbow to elbow formed a human chain. Between the rows of desks, there was not enough space for 2 people to pass each other without first turning sideways. On braver days, you cruised the trading floor to find a manager who would take you under his wing, a mentor, better known to us as a rabbi. You also went to the trading floor to learn. Your first impulse was to step into the fray, select a likely teacher, and present yourself for instruction. Unfortunately, it wasn't so easy. First, a trainee by definition had nothing of merit to say. And second, the trading floor was a minefield of large men on short fuses just waiting to explode if you so much as breathed in their direction. If you happened to step on a mine, then the conversation went something like this. Me. Hello. Trader. What fucking rock did you crawl out from under? Hey Joe, hey Bob, check out this guy's suspenders. Me, reddening. I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. Trader. What the fuck do you think this is? A charity? I'm busy. Me. Can I help in any way? Trader. Give me a burger with ketchup. So I watched my step. There were a million little rules to obey. I knew none of them. Salesmen, traders, and managers swarmed over the floor, and at first I could not tell them apart. Sure, I knew the basic differences. Salesmen talked to investors, traders made bets, and managers smoked cigars. But other than that, I was lost. Most of the men were on 2 phones at once. Most of the men stared at small green screens full of numbers. They'd shout into one phone, then into the other, then at someone across the row of trading desks, then back into the phones, then point to the screen and scream, "Fuck!" 30 seconds was considered a long attention span. I did what every trainee did. I sidled up to some busy person, without saying a word, and became the invisible man. That it was perfectly humiliating was, of course, precisely the point. Sometimes I'd wait for an hour before my existence was formally acknowledged. Other times, a few minutes. But once I'd sidled up, it was difficult to leave without first being officially recognized. To leave was to admit defeat in this peculiar ritual of making myself known. Did I grow more comfortable on the trading floor over time? I suppose. I could see certain developments in myself. One day I was out playing the invisible man, feeling the warmth of the whale shit, and thinking that no one in life was lower than I. Onto the floor rushed a member of the corporate finance department. It must have been his first trip down from his glass box office, and he looked one way and then the other in the midst of the bedlam. Someone bumped into him and sharply told him to watch his step. You could see him thinking that the gaze of the whole world was on him, and he started to panic. Then I thought a nasty thought, a truly unforgivable thought, but it showed I was coming along. What a wimp, I thought. He doesn't have a fucking clue. One morning, John Goodfriend arrived to speak to the class. I hardly expected to hear anything new, but I thought I might learn something indirectly, for he was a man who was said to have stamped his personality onto an institution. His faults as well as his virtues were those of Solomon Brothers. Goodfriend possessed a statesmanlike calmness. He was so intensely calm and deliberate that he made you nervous and suspicious. He paused interminably after each question we asked him. He really seemed to want to know what we were thinking. When a trainee asked him about Solomon Brothers' policy towards charity, Goodfriend, with furrowed brow, after standing silent for an uncomfortably long time, said that charity was a very difficult issue, and he would appreciate our input. The statesman's veneer was a pleasant departure from the gruff, foul-mouthed traitor that people expected John Goodfriend to be. He was round like Churchill, with the thinning white hair of Harry Truman, and the grandeur, if not the height, of de Gaulle. But what had become of the man who claimed to stand ready each morning to bite the ass off a bear? Where was the man who was known around Wall Street for his brutal power plays? The man whose very name struck terror in the hearts of managing directors? We didn't know, and I'm not sure we wanted to find out. After telling us nothing much, but showing us what a world-class financial celebrity looked like up close, he left. As the training program neared its conclusion, the backroom game of liar's poker grew. Bond trading had captured the imaginations of more than half the men in the class. Instead of saying buy and sell like normal human beings, they said bid and offer. At the front of the classroom each morning, a young hopeful shouted, "I'll bid you a quarter for your bagel." Bonds, bonds, and more bonds. Anyone who did not want to trade them for a living wanted to sell them. This group now included several women who had initially hoped to trade. At Solomon Brothers, men traded. Women sold. No one ever questioned the Solomon ordering of the sexes. But the immediate consequences of the prohibition of women in trading was clear to all. It kept women farther from power. A trader placed bets in the markets on behalf of Solomon Brothers. A salesman was the trader's mouthpiece to most of the outside world. The salesman spoke with institutional investors such as pension funds, insurance companies, and savings and loans. The minimum skills required for the two jobs were quite different. Traders required market savvy. Salesmen required interpersonal skills. But the very best traders were also superb salesmen, for they had to persuade a salesman to persuade his customers to buy bond X or sell bond Y. And the very best salesmen were superb traders and found customers virtually giving their portfolios over to them to manage. The difference between a trader and a salesman was more than a matter of mere function. The traders ruled the shop, and it wasn't hard to see why. A salesman's year-end bonus was determined by traders. A trader's bonus was determined by the profits on his trading books. A salesman had no purchase on a trader, while a trader had complete control over a salesman. Not surprisingly, young salesmen dashed around the place looking cowed and frightened, while young traders smoked cigars. That the tyranny of the trader was institutionalized shouldn't surprise anyone. Traders were the people closest to the money. The firm's top executives were traders. John Goodfriend himself had been a trader. Good bond traders had fast brains and enormous stamina. They watched the markets 12 and sometimes 16 hours a day, and not just the market in bonds. They watched dozens of financial and commodity markets, stocks, oil, natural gas, currencies, and anything else that might in some way influence the bond market. They sat down in their chairs at 7 a.m. and stayed put until dark. I quickly came to the conclusion that I could never be a bond trader, from having met a great number of them and not finding one who bore the slightest resemblance to me. We had nothing in common. That made me, by default, a salesman. I found imagining myself as a bond salesman only marginally more plausible than imagining myself as a bond trader. More different types of people succeeded on the trading floor than I initially supposed. Some of the traders were truly awful human beings. They sacked others to promote themselves. They harassed women. They humiliated trainees. They didn't have customers. They had victims. Others were naturally extremely admirable characters. They inspired those around them. They treated their customers almost fairly. They were kind to trainees. The point is that it didn't matter one bit whether a trader was good or evil, as long as he was that most revered of all species, a big swinging dick. If he could make millions of dollars come out of his phones, he became a big swinging dick. After the sale of a big block of bonds and the deposit of a few $100,000 into the Solomon till, a managing director called whoever was responsible to confirm his identity. "Hey, you big swinging dick, way to be." To this day, the phrase brings to my mind the image of an elephant's trunk swaying from side to side. Swish, swash. Nothing in the jungle got in the way of a big swinging dick. That was the prize we coveted. Everyone wanted to be a big swinging dick, even the women. Big swinging dickettes. Christ, even front row people hoped to be big swinging dicks. Because the 41st floor was the chosen home of the firm's most ambitious people, and because there were no rules governing the pursuit of profit and glory, the men who worked there, including the more bloodthirsty, had a hunted look about them. Eat or be eaten. I sat wide-eyed when these people came to speak to the class and observed a behavioral smorgasbord, the likes of which I have never before encountered, except in fiction. And so it was, in this frame of mind, that I first watched the human piranha in action. The human piranha was a bond salesman, and he came to tell us about government bonds. He was the only bond salesman who made traders nervous, because he generally knew their job better than they did, and if they screwed up by giving him a wrong price, he usually made a point of humiliating them on the hoot and holler, a system-wide loudspeaker. It gave other salespeople great satisfaction to watch him do this. The human piranha was short and square. The most unusual thing about him was the frozen expression on his face. His dark eyes rarely moved, and out of his mouth came a steady stream of bottom-line analysis and profanity. The piranha that day began by devouring the government of France. The French government had issued a bond known as the Giscard. Yes, the one described by Tom Wolfe in The Bonfire of the Vanities. Wolfe learned of the Giscard from a Solomon trader. In fact, to research his fictional bond salesman, Wolfe had come to the 41st floor and sat spitting distance from the human piranha. The French had raised about $1 billion in 1978 with the bond. That wasn't the problem. The problem was that the bond was, under certain conditions, exchangeable into gold at $32 an ounce. "The fucking frogs are getting their faces ripped off," said the piranha, meaning that the French were losing a lot of money on the bond issue now that the bond had indeed become convertible and the price of gold was $500 an ounce. The stupidity of the fucking frogs disgusted the piranha. He associated it with their habit of quitting work at 5 p.m. The piranha didn't talk like a person. He said things like, "If you fucking buy this bond in a fucking trade, you're fucking fucked." And, "If you don't pay fucking attention to the fucking 2-year, you get your fucking face ripped off." Noun, verb, adjective. Fucker, fuck, fucking. No part of speech was spared. The human piranha, a Harvard graduate, thought nothing of it. He was always like this. The human piranha turned out to be my favorite person on the 41st floor. There was no bullshit about him. He was brutal, but also honest, and I think fair. The problems on 41 were caused by people who were tough but unfair. You survived the human piranha by simply knowing what you were about. How, though, did you survive a traitor who threw a phone at your head every other time you passed his desk? How did a woman cope with a married managing director who tried to seduce her whenever he found her alone? The training program wasn't a survival course, but sometimes a person came through who put the horrors of 41 into perspective. For me, it was a young bond salesman, just a year out of the training program and at work on 41, named Richard O'Grady. When O'Grady entered the classroom, the first thing he did was to have the video that usually recorded events shut off. Then he closed the door. Then he checked for eavesdroppers on the ledges outside the 23rd floor windows. Only then did he sit down. Only then did he tell us what we really wanted to know. "So you want to know how to deal with those assholes, don't you?" he said. Trainees sort of nodded their heads. O'Grady said he had discovered the secret earlier than most. When he was just starting out, he said, he had an experience that taught him a lesson. He had been a flunky for a senior bond salesman named Penn King, a tall, blonde, big swinging dick if ever there was one. One day King told him to find prices on 4 bonds for a very large customer, Morgan Guarantee. O'Grady therefore asked the relevant trader for prices. When the trader saw him, however, he said, "What the fuck do you want?" "Just a few prices," said O'Grady. "I'm busy," said the trader. "Oh well," thought O'Grady, "I'll see if I can find the prices on the Quotron machine." As O'Grady fiddled with the keyboard of the Quotron, it resembles a personal computer, Penn King demanded the prices for his customer. O'Grady explained what had transpired between himself and the trader. "Then this is what you do, you hear me?" said a completely pissed off Penn King. "You go over to that asshole and you say, 'Look, asshole, since you were so fucking helpful the first time I asked, maybe you could give me the goddamn prices for Morgan Guarantee.'" So O'Grady went back to the trader. When he reached the trader rose to his feet and screamed, "What the fuck are you doing back here? I told you, I am busy." "Look, asshole," said O'Grady, "since you were so fucking helpful the first time I asked, maybe you would be so kind to give me the goddamn prices now." The trader fell back in his chair. O'Grady was, conveniently, about twice the size of the trader. He stood over the trader. "Asshole," he shouted again, for effect. O'Grady walked back to his seat to a standing ovation from 3 or 4 other bond salesmen who had watched the scene develop, and a big grin from Penn. Sure enough, not 2 minutes later, the trader came to him with the prices. "And after that," said O'Grady to a spellbound training program, "he didn't fuck with me again." As you might imagine, this threw the back row into frenzied delight. It had them stomping on the floor like bleacher bums after a grand slam. "What was the secret to dealing with the assholes? Lift weights or learn karate?" said O'Grady. As if to confirm this impression, following on the heels of O'Grady came the mortgage trading department. Every firm on Wall Street has its baddest dudes, and these were ours. They were known for hurling phones at the heads of trainees and were said to have installed extra-long cords to increase their range. In spite of my craven panic in the presence of mortgage traders, I was curious about their business and their boss, Louis Ranieri. All Solomon trainees were curious about Ranieri. Ranieri was the wild and woolly genius, the Solomon legend who began in the mailroom, worked his way onto the trading floor, and created a market in America for mortgage bonds. Ranieri was Solomon, and Solomon was Ranieri. Dozens of trainees wanted to trade mortgage bonds. In the end, 5 were chosen. I was not, which was fine by me. I was shipped to London to become a bond salesman. In due course, I shall return to my private education on the London trading floor. But here it is time to follow the story of Ranieri and the mortgage traders. For not only were they the soul of the firm, they were a microcosm of Wall Street in the 1980s. The mortgage market was one of 2 or 3 textbook cases that illustrated the change sweeping the world of finance. It was January 1985, and Matty Oliva was fresh from Harvard University and the Solomon Brothers training program. The good news was he had landed a plum job on the mortgage trading desk. The bad news was that for his first full year on the desk, he would be an object of abuse. The senior mortgage traders maintained that abuse led to enlightenment. It purged trainees of pretension and made them realize they were the lowest of all God's creations. The traders were to blame for the awful thing about to happen to Matty Oliva. A couple of traders regularly asked Matty to fetch their lunch. They'd holler at him, "Hey, geek, how about some food?" In their less ornery moments, they said, almost politely, "About that time, ain't it, Matty?" There was no need to be polite to Matty, because Matty was a slave. There was no need to tell him exactly what to get, because as every trainee knew, mortgage traders ate anything at any time. Just as some people are mean drunks, mortgage traders were mean gluttons. Nothing angered them more than being without food, unless it was being interrupted while they ate. In other words, they were not the sort of hyperthyroid fat people who meekly sip Diet Cokes all day and prompt one to ask, "So how did he get fat? He never eats." Nor were they the sort of jolly fat people, like Ed McMahon, who are loved because they don't threaten anybody. Mortgage traders were the sort of fat people who grunt from the belly and throw their weight around, like sumo wrestlers. When asked to find food, a trainee on the mortgage desk simply brought back as much of everything as he could carry. On one fateful January day, the beleaguered Matty climbed the 5 flights of stairs from the trading floor to the cafeteria. Matty quickly filled as many plastic trays as he could carry with fries, burgers, Cokes, candy, and a couple of dozen chocolate chip cookies, products of a kitchen known throughout Wall Street for the regular warnings it received from the health inspectors. Then he sneaked past the security guard without paying. Call it an assertion of self. Call it a little cry of freedom from a much-abused soul. Stealing food wasn't Matty's big mistake. His big mistake was to brag to one of the fat traders how he had done it. That afternoon, Matty received a phone call from a man who claimed to work for the Special Projects Division of the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC, this man explained, had been granted jurisdiction over Wall Street's cafeterias, and he was investigating a reported theft of 3 trays of food from the Solomon Brothers cafeteria. "Ha ha ha," said Matty. "Very funny." "No," said the officer. "We're very serious. The ethical standards of Wall Street have to be monitored at all levels." Matty chuckled again and hung up. Matty arrived the next morning to find Michael Mortara, a Solomon Brothers managing director, waiting for him. Mortara was the head of mortgage trading. Mortara looked upset. He asked Matty into his office. "Is it true that you have been stealing food from our cafeteria?" he asked. Matty nodded. "What were you thinking? I really don't know what is going to happen now. Look, go back to your desk and I'll get back to you. This is a problem," said Mortara. The rest of the day, Matty looked as frantic as a lottery winner who had lost his ticket. Although he was a young, much-abused trainee trader, he was nevertheless on the verge of big swinging dickhood. By his 4th year, if he were good at his job, he would be making $1 million before taxes. It was a good time and a great place to be 22 years old. Now this, busted by the SEC in the cafeteria. The next morning, Matty was told to report to good friend's office. Any hope Matty nourished about the reason for the meeting died when he saw Mortara seated beside Goodfriend in the office. Goodfriend went on for some time about how unfunny it was to steal cheeseburgers from the cafeteria. Then he said, "Matthew, I have just concluded a long and painful meeting with the Solomon Brothers Executive Committee, and we've decided to let you stay for now. All I can say now is that there are other issues we need to iron out with the SEC. We'll be back to you." Matty figured his career was ruined. When he returned to his seat on the mortgage desk, he appeared to have witnessed the end of the world. For the 20 or so other mortgage traders, the sight was too much to bear. They tried to hide their snickers behind Quotron machines. Matty had been made the victim of what was known in the department as a goof. Wall Street brings together borrowers of money with lenders. Until the spring of 1978, when Solomon Brothers formed Wall Street's first mortgage security department, the term borrower referred to large corporations and to federal, state, and local governments. It did not include homeowners. But the fastest growing group of borrowers was neither governments nor corporations, but homeowners. The majority of home loans to average Americans were made by the savings and loan industry, which received layers of government support and protection. Nudged by a friendly public policy, savings and loans grew, and the mortgage department surpassed the combined United States stock markets as the largest capital market in the world. Nevertheless, before 1978, on Wall Street it was flaky to think that home mortgages could be big business. Everything about them seemed small and insignificant, at least to people who routinely advised CEOs and heads of state. The typical savings and loan president was the sort of fellow who sponsored a float in the town parade. He wore polyester suits. That said it all, didn't it? A trader would stand up and shout across the trading floor, "I got 10 million IBM 8.5s at 101, and I want these fuckers moved out the door now." Never in a million years could he imagine himself shouting, "I got the $62,000 home mortgage of Mervyn K. Finkelberger. It has 20 years left on it. He's paying 9% interest, and it's a nice little three-bedroom affair just outside Norwalk. Goodbye, too." A single home mortgage was a messy investment for Wall Street, which was used to dealing in bigger numbers. No trader or investor wanted to poke around suburbs to find out whether the homeowner to whom he had just lent money was creditworthy. At the very least, a mortgage had to be pooled with other mortgages of other homeowners. Traders and investors would trust statistics and buy into a pool of several thousand mortgage loans made by a savings and loan, of which, by the laws of probability, only a small fraction should default. Pieces of paper could be issued that entitled the bearer to a pro rata share of the cash flows from the pool, a guaranteed slice of a fixed pie. Thus standardized, the pieces of paper could be traded. Robert Dahl, a Solomon Brothers partner, saw the wave coming and produced a 3-page memo summarizing the market for the Solomon Brothers Executive Committee. This memo convinced John Goodfriend to establish a mortgage department with Dahl as the manager. It was the spring of 1978, and Goodfriend had just been appointed chairman of the firm by his predecessor, William Solomon, the son of one of the firm's three founding fathers. Dahl acted as a financier to negotiate with banks and thrifts to persuade them to sell their loans. These loans would be transformed into mortgage bonds. Dahl needed a big-name trader to inspire confidence in investors. Dahl had to borrow a proven winner from either the corporate or the government bond trading desks. He got his first choice, Louis Ranieri, a 30-year-old utility bond trader. Ranieri's move to the mortgage department was a seminal event on the eve of the golden age of the bond trader. With his appointment in mid-1978, the story of the mortgage market, as it is conventionally told within Solomon Brothers, commences. Dahl knows precisely why he selected Ranieri. Louis, he says, was not just a trader. He had the mentality and the will to create a market. He was tough-minded. He didn't mind hiding a $1 million loss from a manager, if that's what it took. He didn't let morality get in the way. Well, morality is not the right word, but you know what I mean. When John Goodfriend told Louis he would be joining Dahl as head trader in the embryonic mortgage security department, Louis panicked. In Louis's view, there would be no chunk of bonus money at the end of the year in the mortgage department. In retrospect, his fears look laughably absurd, but at the time of his appointment, he felt cheated. Ranieri was a sophomore English major at St. John's College when he took a part-time job on the night shift in the Solomon Brothers mailroom in 1968. The Solomon paycheck was $70 a week. Several months into his new job, he ran into money problems. His wife lay ill in the hospital, and the bills simply accumulated. Ranieri needed $10,000. He was 19 years old. He was finally forced to request a loan from the one Solomon partner he knew vaguely. "You gotta remember," he says now, "I was convinced, really convinced he was going to fire me." Instead, Solomon Brothers paid. There was no committee meeting to discuss whether this was appropriate. It was understood that the bill would be paid, for no reason other than it was the right thing to do. The act moved Ranieri deeply. When he speaks of loyalty, of the covenant between Solomon Brothers and the people who work for Solomon Brothers, it is that single generosity he remembers. From supervisor of the mailroom, he moved out to the clerical back office, which brought him directly in contact with traders. By 1974, he was sitting where he wanted, in the utility bond trader seat on the corporate bond desk. Up to the point of his transfer to the mortgage department, Ranieri had dominated every department he joined. The firm encouraged both aggression and ability. It made a point never to interfere with natural jungle forces.